The inspiration for our series going through Psalm 23 happened this past summer for me when I had a severe concussion and I was laid up on the couch for several weeks. And I would imagine a thought I had is similar to a thought that you've had when you've had an accident or a significant life event that forced you to slow down. The thought I had was, why does it take such a significant event to force me to slow down? Why can't I just learn to live this way? Why is this so difficult for me? Psalm 23 invites us into a place of rest. But I think as we investigate verse 2 of this chapter, that we'll be surprised by what rest actually looks like. And so we're going to be investigating verse 2 specifically today. Before we go any further, though, each Sunday when we gather, we are saying aloud together, reciting Psalm 23. And my challenge to all of you is to memorize these six verses of Psalm 23. Our children in their classes this morning are going to be working on memorizing Psalm 23. They're going to have an opportunity to be given a little lamb if they can memorize it. There'll be readers in the lobby as they arrive, and they can recite Psalm 23 to the readers and then be given a prize. There's a call and response way that they can do it for some kids who are younger, and memorization's a little bit more difficult. And our youth on Thursday night are also working on memorizing Psalm 23. So that means you adults, you got to lead the way. You got to memorize it. And then on our last Sunday in Psalm 23, which is March 1st, we're going to gather in here. We're going to invite all of our kids from their kids' classes. There's going to be no words on the screen. And we're all going to recite Psalm 23 together. And you do not want to stick out like a sore thumb. So put in a little bit of work and you can memorize these six verses. Okay, so we're going to read Psalm 23 together. Would you stand as we read the ESV translation's take on Psalm 23? And if you were here last Sunday, you might remember that my dad took a stab at reading this from memory, and it didn't go so well. So I'm going to be a little bit smarter, learn from my elders, and I'm going to read along with you on the screen. Let's begin. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Amen. You can be seated. My family and I recited Psalm 23 over dinner last night, and none of the kids have it memorized, so we're putting in the work too, right alongside you. We live in an incredibly loud world, and what I mean by that is there are notifications, and traffic, and media, and conversations, and even when the external noise of our lives dissipates, then the internal noise just takes over. We'll replay the events of yesterday and we'll start to rehearse what's coming tomorrow, all while kind of living overwhelmed with anxiety in the present. We are rarely alone in silence, even as we practice just 1 minute of silence earlier. I'm sure for many of you that 1 minute felt like eternity because it was uncomfortable to be in silence. Silence and rest, in theory, sounds wonderful, but in practice can be a little bit unsettling. 10 years ago, Microsoft built a room that's officially recognized by the Guinness Book of World Records as the quietest room in the world. It's a room called an anechoic chamber, and I have a picture of it here, and I'll kind of describe what you're looking at. The walls are filled with fiberglass panels that are meant to reduce echoes so that you can't hear any bounce or vibration in the room. The floor of the room sits on vibration-dampening strings so that you, as you walk, it doesn't create any noise. And then surrounding this, and what you can't see in the picture, is layers of concrete and steel surrounding the room. All of this produces a deadening effect in the room to where every noise is amplified tenfold. It sits at 20 decibels lower than what the human ear can hear. That's the ambient noise in the room before anything enters in. And so people have entered into this room, and they've described their experience as rather strange and very unlike our normal way of living. When you first enter the room, you immediately start to hear your own breathing in a way that is louder than you've ever heard it before. And then a few seconds later, you start to hear your heartbeat in a way that is overwhelming. And then some of you might relate to this already, but as you turn your body or your neck, you hear your ligaments and bones start to make noise. Some of you, you know, might have that experience in just normal life. You don't need a quiet room for that. But other people have described, because there's no noise bouncing around, their brain struggles with spatial understanding, and so they can lose their balance because there's no sense of sound to kind of ground their body. The guy who helped create or design the chamber said this about the room. He said, "Most people find the absence of sound deafening." And I thought that was a really great way to put it. It almost sounds contradictory, but it's a telling statement that a peaceful place is something that we can only actually tolerate for a few minutes. And the guy who designed the chamber said the longest anyone has ever spent in there is 55 minutes, and that most people self-opt out of the room after a few seconds or even up to a minute because the noise is just overwhelming in a way that they'd never understood before. And I think in a similar way, this idea of quiet and silence, it forces us to confront the noise that usually kind of overwhelms our lives. It exposes our restlessness, our anxiety, our exhaustion. And I think what it then reveals is that our struggle to enter into restful periods isn't so much time or desire, it's actually trust. We like to be in control, and to truly be silent exposes our desire to have something going on. And Psalm 23, in the first couple of verses, really highlight the shepherd. Not what we do, but what the shepherd does. And then from there, we're invited into a place of rest. And so today our focus is on verse 2 of Psalm 23. The two sentences, I know we covered 5 words in week 1 and 4 words in week 2. Today we're really expanding and we're covering 2 sentences. "He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters." Before the shepherd pushes us with correction or a calling, the shepherd invites us into a place of rest. A place of rest. But being brought to this place of rest, I think, happens differently than we might assume, or the assumptions we have about rest can be adjusted as we look at Psalm 23:2. So I want to look at the first sentence of green pastures, the second sentence of still waters, and then toward the end, we'll kind of apply this into what I think Psalm 23 is pushing us toward. So the first part, the assumption that we might need to have reoriented is that rest is the result of not being quiet, but being led. Being led. "He makes me lie down in green pastures." And that phrase, "he makes me," I'm sure stands out to you, because in our English language, we read that as somebody that forces you to go to green pastures. But in the original language, it's really more that he leads. He's leading us somewhere, and we have to also then be willing to follow. He's making, and whether we read this as positive or negative, somebody making you go somewhere, is ultimately about whether we trust them to do something good for us. It's whether their perspective is helpful or not is whether we trust them and where they're leading us. A few years ago, my wife and I, Rose, we spent a couple days, I think 3 or 4 days, in a 5-star resort in the mountains of Colorado at a horse ranch. And during our the lead up to our trip, this was just a bunch of other pastors and their wives and spouses that we had won the trip. It was an amazing gift. And a few weeks before we went, they emailed us just saying, "Hey, if you have any like things we should know for your time staying with us, let us know." And my wife at the time had pretty significant dietary restrictions of things she could eat or couldn't eat. And so we emailed that off to them, and she got an email back from the head chef a couple days later that kind of went through like all of their plans of how to accommodate her dietary needs. And then the day we arrived, the head chef came out and had a conversation with her to reiterate his desire to kind of come alongside her needs and to provide meals that would allow for her to eat and be able to have all of the food that she would need while she was there. And then every morning, we would show up for breakfast, and somebody from the kitchen staff would come and sit down next to Rose, would go over the menu for the day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and dessert. And they even had a specially made dessert only for her that she could eat. Now, she was being led somewhere. She didn't get to choose what she was eating, but she was being led somewhere by somebody that clearly had knowledge and care for her. And what it allowed her to experience during our 4 days there was rest. All of her needs were being taken care of. And in a similar way, I think when you have someone who has your best in mind and they push you somewhere, it's not a burden. It's a relief. You get to experience a posture and a picture of rest when they take you to a place that you might not have otherwise gone, but they and their goodness bring you there. And I think that's something that the shepherd is doing here when he's saying he makes us lie down in green pastures. And this language or this idea of being led really paints a picture for us around the book of Exodus, and ideas and language that David is drawing on from the story of God's people in the book of Exodus. For those of you that don't know the backstory of the book of Exodus, essentially God's people, the Israelites, had been in Egypt for 400 years living as slaves. And God raised up a guy named Pharaoh to confront a guy named Pharaoh, little important detail there, and to allow God's people to be released from their bondage in captivity. And God led the people through the sea toward the promised land, a miraculous deliverance for God's people. And immediately after they had been brought to this place of deliverance, Moses wrote a song, really a worship song, in Exodus 15. And right in the middle of that worship song, Moses emphasizes the way in which God led them. He said in verse 13, "In your strength, you will guide them to your holy dwelling." Now, here's why I'm emphasizing this particular verse, because that verse has particular words and phrases that David uses in Psalm 23:2. For instance, "In your strength, you will guide them." That word in the original Hebrew language is the same word David uses in the second half of verse 2. "He leads me beside still waters." "He leads me and you will guide them." Same word. And then the end of Exodus 15:13, "He guides them to his holy dwelling," is the same word, or the root word at least, for pasture in Psalm 23, the first sentence, "green pastures." So what David is doing is he's borrowing the language of Israel's deliverance and rescue. Exodus was not just about getting people out of slavery, it was about bringing people to rest. God did not lead them through the sea so they could wander endlessly in fear, though they did for 40 years due to their own way and desires. He desired to lead them to a place of promise, a land where they could dwell in safety and provision. And that's really what pasture means here then. David's not talking about grass. What he's talking about is safety, care, provision, stability, a place where striving can stop because all your needs are met. The Lord has provided. And David is saying that this same God, the one who led the Israelites through the sea into a place of deliverance, out of bondage, into freedom, is the same God who is now leading him, leading David. The shepherd who led Israel out of slavery is guiding him. In other words, the God of redemption leading them is the God of rest, to a place of rest. And in this way, Psalm 23:2 is not a poetic expression only, though it is that. It's more than that. It really is a description about who God is. He's the one who leads and guides and makes us go to the places of rest. But we resist this, right? Why don't we experience this? Because we often want to be in control of our own existence, our own destination. We don't want to follow someone else. We want to do what we want to do. And so therefore, we don't enter into this place of rest because the one who is trying to guide us there is not the voice that we're listening to. The sheep don't lay down in the pasture because the pasture is perfect. The sheep lie down because the shepherd is there. And so the question, I think, of Psalm 23 here in verse 2 that invites us to ask is not, are you tired? Not, do you think you need rest? I would imagine almost all of us would say, yeah, I'm tired, and yes, I need rest. But really, Psalm 23:2 is asking us to ask the question instead, who are you trusting to lead you? Who is the one that's guiding you forward? Whose voice are you listening to? So rest is first about being led. Secondly, the second sentence of this verse, he leads me beside still waters. Rest is about arrival, not escape. And again, I think that kind of changes the assumptions that we might make about rest. This verse, he leads me beside still waters, could literally be translated, he leads me beside waters of rest. The still waters are waters of rest. And in this way, the shepherd bringing you to this place of rest is a place that we arrive to, not that we're leaving somewhere else. And I think this is an important distinction because we often associate times of rest with leaving what we might consider normal life. We go on vacation, or we go on a date, and we leave behind all the normal responsibilities of life to go do that other thing somewhere else. And we associate rest with that place that we go to. But that's not what David's saying here. Actually, rest is. Rest is being brought somewhere, not leaving somewhere else. In this language of a resting place or waters of rest is language that the Bible uses all throughout the story of the Bible. It starts in the Garden of Eden, Genesis 2, where God places Adam and Eve, and they are in the presence of God, and there's work that's there, but it's this environment of rest because God's presence is with them and alongside them. And even after God delivers his people out of Egypt, in the book of Exodus, they wander in the wilderness for many years, and God constantly, and especially in the book of Deuteronomy, is reminding them, you have not entered fully into the rest that I desire you to experience. He's talking about rest as a destination, the promised land that he wants to bring them to. And as you fast forward through the story of Scripture, you'll ultimately be brought to the book of Revelation, where God's people are led to living water, where hunger and thirst is no more. From the Garden of Eden and creation to the deliverance of the promised land to the new creation of God's return in Christ. Rest is always tied to being with God in the place that he provides. So rest biblically is not disengagement from life, it's arrival in connection with the shepherd. And I think this then helps us understand, why is rest so elusive for us. Sure, we want our own way and we want to be in control, but we look at rest as changing circumstances. I'll be able to slow down when. When I get that time away, then I'll be able to experience a place of rest. Sheep don't simply lie down because the day is over. They lie down because the shepherd has provided. A few weeks ago, I mentioned a book by a guy named Philip Keller, who for his adult life worked as a shepherd and then wrote a book on Psalm 23, applying the principles he had learned working as a shepherd to what's written about in Psalm 23. And one of the things that he mentions about verse 2 is that sheep need circumstances to be adjusted in order to truly rest and lie down. And he highlighted four things that sheep need in order to rest. The first is they need freedom from fear. Sheep are naturally timid and anxious animals. And when they get a sense of a threat, they will run away and try and hide as best as they can. But they certainly won't lay down. But when the presence of the shepherd is nearby, they'll know that they're safe and that there's nothing to fear, and that they can lay down and rest. Secondly, they need freedom from friction. Friction meaning interpersonal struggle with other sheep. When they're brought into especially close quarters with other sheep, they can start to butt heads a little bit. They want their own space. But they know when the shepherd's around, if they're messing around with each other, they're going to get in trouble. And so they start to calm down, and then they'll be able to rest. Thirdly, and maybe most humorously, they need freedom from flies. Flies. Flies, in this instance, are just like the little irritants in life that keep you just kind of on edge and a little anxious. In the case of sheep, and we'll talk about this more when we get to verse 5, is this freedom of flies is what a shepherd will do, is we'll put oil over the fur and the face of the sheep so that the flies can't land on them and be an irritant anymore, as a way of protecting and caring for them. And then number 4, freedom from hunger. Freedom from hunger. A hungry sheep will never lie down. It'll keep trying to eat around it. And this way, the shepherd actually keeps the sheep moving so that there's always fresh grass for them to continue to eat. And then when they've had enough, then they can rest. Now, it might look like on the surface here, I've contradicted myself, because I've just said that rest is arrival, not leaving. And rest is not based on circumstances, it's based on the presence of the shepherd. And yet here I've given an example of sheep need 4 circumstances to change in order to rest. So which is it? And what I would like to highlight here is these circumstances have changed, not because the sheep have done something for themselves, but because the shepherd has taken care of their needs. He's provided an environment in which they're able to rest. So rest in this instance isn't about the circumstances changing per se. It's about the shepherd being present. And then from there, him providing in substantial ways. As a preparation for knowing I was going to be sharing about verse 2 and rest, I listened to a podcast with a pastor sharing on the subject of rest, just to kind of see what he would say. And one of the things that he said was really, it just stuck out to me. He said, what Christians need for a growing maturity of faith is more quiet. More quiet. And I thought, you know, there's aspects of that that I could agree with. Like, you all should probably be on your phone less. I think that's a fair assumption. Maybe a little less television time. You should embrace a Sabbath, a 24-hour period of time every week where you cease from the things you normally do to instead spend time with the ones you love and be able to more fervently seek the Lord. Those would all be really healthy, spiritually mature things that I think would bless and aid your walk of life. But then there was another kind of thought that came into my mind, this idea that what a Christian needs in order to grow is more quiet. Is like, well, what about the people that don't have very much quiet in their lives? Are we just saying that spiritual maturity is not a possibility for them? What about parents with young kids? Like, there's not very much quiet happening in your house. What about somebody who works in like the emergency room as a nurse? Constant noise and interruption all day long. Are we saying that rest is an impossibility for people who have kind of busier or more chaotic lives than some of the rest of us? And so in this way, I started to think about the fact that rest has to be something more than just changing circumstances, more quiet in your lives. It has to be more than just simply a technique in which we free up space in our lives. What about rest as we're going through life? What could that look like? And I think the picture that Psalm 23 is inviting us to embrace is that rest is not something we do, it's a person to know. It's a person that we receive and who has offered himself to us. And so I, at the end of the notes here, I just put quite simply, rest is not found in quiet, as we might say, but rest is found in Jesus. Quite simply, it's found in him. And to help us see this, I want to look at a story based on the earthly ministry of Christ in Mark chapter 6. It's a story that's pretty well known as the feeding of the 5,000. And what I think the story does is it brings together themes that we've been emphasizing here. There's an Exodus theme, there's a Psalm 23 sheep and shepherd theme, and we see how it all kind of culminates in who Christ is and how he operates. So if you have a Bible, it'll be on the screen as well, but Mark chapter 6, and we're going to look at verse 31 to 39, and I want you to kind of listen for the themes that I just mentioned and that we've been talking about coming out in these verses. And in the lead up to this, the disciples have just learned that John the Baptist has been killed by King Herod. And they go to Jesus and they tell him about what happened. And Jesus responds by saying at the end of verse 31, "Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest." And that word quiet could be translated also as desolate or deserted or wilderness. Now again, think about the story of Exodus and how they wandered in the wilderness and God brought them to a place of rest. Jesus is using Exodus language here. Come to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. Or again, a wilderness place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. So they go to this place for rest, and a bunch of people show up, and their rest is interrupted by a crowd. And Jesus shows up, and he's present in it. Let's continue. Verse 35, "By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a remote place,' they said, 'and it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat.'" It's almost like they're saying, "We're supposed to be resting right now, right? Let's get rid of the people." But Jesus answered, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "That would take more than half a year's wages. Are we to go and spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat?" "How many loaves do you have?" he asked. "Go and see." When they found out, they said, five loaves and two fish. When Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down, then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So again, let's pick up on some of these themes that are jumping out. Jesus wants to bring them to a place of rest, a desolate place, away from distractions and noise, a place of rest. And they're there for a short period of time before they're interrupted by a large crowd who shows up, and Jesus says, "We're going to feed them. Go find them some food. I don't care if it takes half a year's wages. Bring whatever you got, and I'll take care of it." And then Jesus brings this large crowd of people to a green pasture. in order to allow them to partake and be provided for. Just like the God of Israel provided manna in the wilderness, Jesus fed this crowd in a deserted wilderness place. And later on in John 6, Jesus would point all of this back to him when he would say, "I am the bread of life." The crowd thought what they needed was some food, but what Jesus ultimately says is that I am the fulfillment. The deepest longing of your hunger cannot be satisfied by mere bread alone. What you need is my presence, the provision I have to give. So the crowd that's led to the green grass by Jesus and he feeds them is highlighting how being led by Jesus ultimately leads to being fed by him as well. You follow his voice and then he provides. And in Psalm 23, David, using a similar idea, says that green pastures and still waters become the place that God restores each of us. In Hebrews 2, even ties in this idea of rest together by saying to us in Hebrews 4:11, make every effort to enter that rest. Meaning, it's an invitation, it's an opportunity, it's set before each of you. Even in the chaos, you can enter the rest. It's available to you. And as Psalm 23 goes on, he kind of highlights a summary of where Jesus has brought this and the shepherd has brought them by saying, he restores my soul. The green pasture, the still water becomes the place of restoration. And we could kind of summarize it like this. If you want Jesus to restore your soul, you have to let Jesus lead your life. And I think we quite often get these things flipped around. We want the provision and the blessing of God, but we don't always want to follow him. We oftentimes want to go our own way. But if you want the restoration of your soul and God's provision and presence and blessing in your life, you got to listen. You got to let him lead. You got to let him guide your life. Jesus offers the living water that quenches our thirst, the bread that satisfies our hunger, but only if we're willing to follow him. We often want him to feed our souls, but we don't always want him to lead our lives. So the question of Psalm 23, and I think Mark 6 becomes an echo of this as well. The question is not whether you admire Jesus or whether you like what he has to say or you appreciate his vision for the good life, but it's whether you're willing to follow him. Are you willing to follow him? And I don't think following him has to be a burden. It can be a posture of living in rest every moment of every day. And I got an analogy comes to mind for me. Imagine that you are dating someone and you really like this person, and eventually you've told them that you love them, but they're not quite ready to say it back to you. And so you're a little bit uncertain of how things are going to progress. And at the same time, they just bought some IKEA furniture, let's say, and they've asked you, would you put this together for me? Because they know it's going to take 4 or 5 hours. There's probably going to be parts missing. It's going to be frustrating. And you know it, but you care about them a lot. And so you're like, sure, let's do this. Let's do this. The day arrives in which you said, I'm willing to help you put together this furniture. And they come to you before you've even started. And they say, hey, I have something I want to tell you. I love you too. That work that you were kind of like annoyed by, frustrated by, is no longer a burden. You are ready to run through a wall. You'll do anything for that person because you've experienced their affirmation, care, and love. There's nothing you wouldn't do. Even the worst IKEA furniture in the world pales in comparison to the amount of stuff that you'd be willing to do in that moment. And I think that's an example of the kind of rest that Christ offers us. He is the one who says to you, I love you. And our then response is to enter the rest, moment by moment, day by day. There's a pastor named Matthew Henry in the late 1600s, early 1700s, and one of the things he did is he wrote a commentary on the whole Bible, verse by verse. And in Psalm 23:2, he had this to say, which I think fits really well. He said, "The greatest abundance is but a dry pasture to a wicked man, who relishes only in which pleases the senses." He's never satisfied. "But the godly man who tastes the goodness of God in all his enjoyments and by faith relishes that, though he has but little of the world, it is a green pasture." And I think we could then kind of summarize what he's saying. Anywhere that the shepherd leads can become a green pasture. And as we get into verse 4, even when the shepherd leads you into the valley of the shadow of death, even that valley can be a green pasture. Rest is not found in how much we have or how quiet our lives are. It's ultimately found in how our hearts are anchored. What anchors your life? Which voice are you letting lead you? True rest doesn't require a perfectly quiet environment, though that can certainly be an aid. It requires a faithful shepherd and a willingness from his sheep to respond to and follow his voice. And so the invitation for us today is very simple, but not easy: to stop striving, to stop searching, and to let yourself be led, and to follow the voice of the shepherd. When Jesus is your shepherd, even the noisiest seasons of life can become green pastures of rest as he leads and guides. Rest is not found in silence alone. It's found in him alone. And as we move toward our time of response and partaking of communion today, I just thought of the words that Jesus says at the end of Matthew 11, and I really appreciate Eugene Peterson's take on these words in the Message paraphrase. The words aren't on the screen. I just like to read them and have them kind of wash over you. Jesus says, "Are you tired, worn out, burned out on religion? Come to me, get away with me, and you'll recover your life. I'll show you how to take a real rest. Walk with me and work with me. Watch how I do it. Learn the unforced rhythms of grace. I won't lay anything heavy or ill-fitting on you. Keep company with me, and you'll learn to live freely and lightly." And those words, I think, lead us to the communion table, where we partake of and remind ourselves of all Christ has done so that we could experience his grace and presence in our lives.